there we are with the brown tape. This is Paul Rodell one more time, the IVS Oral History Project. Today is the 1st of September, and I'm in the home of, help me out with the pronunciation, Richard or Dick Cagle? Cagle,
correct.
Okay. And in Madison, Wisconsin. Dick was in South Vietnam from 1957 through 1959, working in a number of different areas, agriculture, community development. Obviously came early during the time of Par Danforth, and was with, I think he described as a second wave of volunteers. So we're here today to talk about his volunteer experience in IVS and reflections on it and evaluations on it some years later. And as I said before I turned this on, we're not only looking at the time you were in Vietnam, but something about yourself. So the first question, all of them open-ended, so that you can take off wherever you want to, is, like, with some exceptions, a kind of at least year of when you were born and where you place for where you were born. But something about your parents, not only their names, but who they were in the sense of human beings and, you know, what they did on the earth and how they brought you up and your siblings and their role in the community, and then the various influences on your life, which could have come from any one of a number of sources, from family to Cub Scouting to school to religion to you name it. And all of these getting you up to the point where you were prepared to consider some sort of project or service like an IVS. And I'll just basically sit back except to chirp in and perhaps follow up or lead around.
Well, I was born on the outskirts of Milwaukee in 1932. Mm-hmm. My parents and forebears were part of that large wave of German immigrants that had come into the United States in the 1840s and 1850s and settled in Wisconsin just mm-hmm. because that was the frontier at the time. Mm-hmm. And so my parents, I guess I would say, are third generation Americans, and grew up in a pretty Germanized part of the United States. My mother, prior to marrying, had been a school teacher, mm-hmm. the type that had the 1 year training at a normal school, uh-huh. and at the age of 19 started teaching school, mm-hmm. and taught for maybe 7 years when she met my dad, who was in the local school district where she was teaching, and he had done various things, some farming, some work as a handyman, and so forth. And at the time they were married, according to local custom, that was the end of her teaching career, because
no
married women did not teach, single women taught.
Really?
And so that was a big decision on her part.
Wow.
To marry and in a sense lose her profession. But they did. They married in 1929, just in time for the Big Depression. And my dad, who was working as kind of a carpenter handyman at Sears Roebuck, immediately lost his job. And he had applied for some civil service jobs. And particularly, he was looking, or would have liked one, at the Milwaukee County Airport, which was very near to our home, mm-hmm. and instead he was called up by the Milwaukee County Civil Service group to work as a temporary employee in handling out relief supplies, because there was this tremendous amount of want and unemployment at the time, and Milwaukee was something of a leader in trying to alleviate this handout. Surplus farm commodities, etc. So he got caught up in that, and it turned out to be his life work
oh, really?
As a civil service employee for Milwaukee County. I think he was a temporary employee for 12 years and eventually became a permanent employee. And I think during the Depression, he earned on the order of $90 a month. And,
that was fairly decent.
It was fairly decent relative to those who weren't earning anything.
Yeah.
It was steady work.
Yeah, which was good in and of itself.
And but it was considerably less, for example, than my mother had been earning as a teacher prior to when she was married. She was earning up to maybe the $125, $150 range. So they had the small home farm, and they did a lot of food raising and those kinds of things. And my mother was very adept in learning things. I think all of our clothing was made by her up until the time we went to high school, maybe out of cast off some the relatives. And she did all the canning and even soap making out of waste fat, and just lived very frugally on lack of expense. And I guess I look at some of these kind of activities as being useful when you get overseas in that type of an environment. I had an appreciation of how to live frugally and simply, I guess.
You know, you mentioned one thing about your dad that captures my interest as a teacher who has to talk to young undergraduates today. You said he was a carpenter for Sears and Roebuck.
Mm-hmm. Carpenter handyman, sort of.
Carpenter handyman, okay. So did he assemble some of those prefab homes that Sears sold?
No, he not to my knowledge. I think his work was largely in the store, setting up displays, setting up offices and cubby holes and so forth. Just the types of things that had to take place to keep the store
running. That's too
bad. Running. And anyway, as soon as Sears started seeing red ink at the beginning of the Depression, they told him that he was no longer needed. And he said, well, you know, I bought this set of furniture when I married, which I'm still paying on. I won't be able to keep it and pay it off if I'm not working here. So they said, well, let's not be hasty. And so they kept him on for another 3 months so he could pay off on this set of furniture. And then, of course, they, at that time, it was over.
Yeah, oh gosh, you should have bought more furniture.
Should have had a bigger debt.
Yeah, I guess.
Kept himself going longer, but...
Well, I talk about the Sears Company. What, let me just pause this because it's not relevant to your thing. It's not.
My dad spent a lot of his life trying to improve the home we lived in because it had started out as a log cabin.
Oh, really?
In the 1840s, built by a great uncle of his, and at the turn of the century, bought by his father. They moved out into this ramshackle place, and he literally spent a large part of his life fixing up this house, adding on to it, improving it, and up until, well, when he was married in 1929, made it into a duplex so his parents could live upstairs while he started his family downstairs. So that house, in which he still lives today after 90 years of occupancy, is a very big part of his life. And he, of course, provided the shelter for us as we were growing up, despite not having a lot of finances around. And I guess maybe my mother was one of these ultimate volunteers when I think of all the activities she took part in the community as being a 4-H leader and officer in the Homemakers and a Sunday school teacher and a member of the local school board. And as part of that, she would go out and take the school census each summer, go the entire school district and find out who had what kids and how old they were, and et cetera, and make out the school census. And then she would solicit money for the Red Cross and for the community chest. And
she was a busy woman.
She was just a tremendous public-spirited person. My dad was a much more quiet type of guy, but he always backstopped. She never lacked for backstopping from him. But she was the face on the world, I guess you might say.
Yeah.
And
a very positive, service-oriented phase, too.
Very much so.
Yeah, yeah.
And then later on in her life, she did work as a homebound teacher after we kids had grown up, and my dad was near retirement, and she served as a homebound teacher for kids who were sick in one way or another.
Oh, okay.
Could not go
all
to
right.
school. She'd go into the homes and teach them so they could keep up to their grade level. So she did that for a decade or so, as long as her health allowed. And so I guess I grew up in that kind of an atmosphere, and I was fairly involved in the 4-H movement, and in about 1953 I got the opportunity to go overseas as part of the International Farm Youth Exchange program, and I guess that opened up a lot of windows on the world to me, that other people live differently, and were no crazier than we were. And, so I came back and was very interested in doing something overseas again. I had a brief year and a half or so employment with General Motors after I finished up my college degrees, which were in agriculture and mechanical engineering. It was a combined program called called agricultural engineering.
Where was this?
This was at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison.
Right here.
And so then went out with General Motors for about a year and a half. Did not really felt I fit in with that scene, and then volunteered to go with IBS in 1957.
So let me back up. When were your college years?
My college years were a little bit stretched out from about 1950 to 1956.
Okay.
Because
the chronology wasn't fitting exactly into a 4-year scheme.
Yeah. A couple of reasons for this. One is that it was a dual degree program.
So it was elongated.
Got an ag degree and the mechanical engineering degree. Plus, I did spend one of my undergraduate years in Germany. I'd been there under the International Farm Youth Exchange program. Got an opportunity to get an exchange scholarship, so spent a year there, and that stretched things out a little bit. So.
But it also intensifies your interest in things overseas.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And came back, graduated with the dual BS degrees, and after about a year and a quarter, year and a half with General Motors, did volunteer to go with IBS to Vietnam.
Well, first of all, it's something that occurs to me. That 6 years of schooling, your parents could help you with this, or how do you finance yourself?
Well, I was able to finance myself pretty well, surprisingly, as a musician.
Played
with a number of dance bands of varying levels of quality and corniness, I guess I would say.
Yeah, okay.
But it was an interesting experience. It was a broadening experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Too. It was a fun experience.
Sure.
And, I had to work fairly hard, completing these two degrees, and so earning my money that way was a nice diversion. It was something totally different, and and it was fairly lucrative relative to working, I think, at 85 cents an hour is what students were getting paid in the various jobs at that time.
Yeah.
You know, I could earn several times that, so that was very, very nice. And, make my living in relatively fewer hours per week, and maybe more interestingly.
So professional musician as well.
Well, at that time I would have used that word professional. Today I guess I would maybe use the word mercenary musician.
Okay.
Professional now indicates something a little different to me than it maybe would have been. Mercenary musician.
Okay, a mercenary musician. I'll accept that.
And actually I heard about IBS through the International Farm Youth Exchange program. They sent out newsletters to we who were alumni. And
I was going to ask you how you heard.
Somehow the two groups got together, and in their newsletters they would mention that IBS was looking for people. And I think the original place that IBS mentioned to me was Iraq. where Bob Yeats
just sent a few times. Yeah,
and apparently that program was faltering or was being...
He was only there about 3 months.
Yeah, being terminated. So then suddenly Dr. Noffsinger started talking about Vietnam. And of course, like many people, I had to quickly run to the Atlas and find out where this was. And
you found out about IBS through this other means.
Mm-hmm.
But who talked to you about IBS? Who interviewed you for this?
I went, after some correspondence, went down to Chicago and met with Dr. Noffsinger, who was
traveling
on his way
around
through Chicago.
Okay.
And I took the train.
Where's your son?
I cannot get the
side. Okay. I put this back on again.
Okay.
So, yeah, so he was just traveling through.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't have somebody going around in a kind of recruitment interview for the organization.
That was pretty much the interview.
Yeah.
And my impression of him was a little bit strange in that mm-hmm. we met at a certain hotel or restaurant to eat.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to keep my overcoat on during the meal because he was either had had a chill or he had been overheated and didn't want to have a chill. So during this meal, he was eating in his overcoat.
That is kind of a little different.
Somewhat strange impression on me. But he's very enthusiastic and told about his experiences as a young man in the Philippines, of which you may have heard. And
I've heard a little bit about it.
And later on, I was able to see some of the places he had mentioned in the Philippines, places he had been able to reach only on foot or by ox cart, which I was able to reach by a rickety bus of some kind.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I knew things had developed in the meantime. But he was very enthusiastic about his experiences as a young man. And
yeah.
Felt that we could have similarly positive experiences. So he really, you know, despite his age and any quirkiness he might have had, he could convey some enthusiasm.
He was a good salesman.
Yeah.
For this adventure.
And also, you know, thinking back on the founders of IBS, I think he was fairly typical. They were church-related people. Most of them were ex-missionaries, had overseas experience. They had a vision that young people had a role to serve, and they attributed some statement that Eisenhower had made in his inaugural address about involving more Americans in our overseas.
Is that the point four thing?
Yeah, very possibly.
Okay.
But anyway, something that Eisenhower had said in his inaugural address, they could see that there might be some possibility here for setting up a youth group to work overseas in a positive way. And this was not, at that point, a totally accepted idea. This was pre-Peace Corps days.
Absolutely.
If you've seen some of the discussions about the Peace Corps when it was proposed, there were some pretty negative viewpoints on this.
Yeah.
So this was not a totally accepted.
Well, there's always people who disparage youth.
Yes.
There always are. You know, and you just have to react to that.
You know, later on, when the Peace Corps was discussed, IVS was at some points used as an example, saying, well, this can work, and here's
how they do it, and let's take a look,
and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was unhappy in my job with General Motors, so IVS began looking better all the time, and it evolved to...
It's a little bit of job... Not dissatisfaction, but unsatisfaction.
Yeah, or just lack of a match between my interests and needs in that particular position. And it had to do with inertial guidance systems, which at that point were used on rockets.
And yeah.
I had a little crisis of conscience there. I wasn't that interested in working on something that at that time only had the function of potentially blowing up some poor devil somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, these systems are used on all the passenger airplanes and everything.
Yeah, so it's very wide now.
It's gotten to be something that it would have been much more acceptable to me, but at You know, that was one of my problems with the job.
Well, you didn't have a crystal ball. You couldn't tell how how the thing would play out and be used.
And lovers of technology would say, well, let's see, you know, always.
Yeah, you can work on anything, it'll be okay.
It'll
yeah.
Be okay. So.
Okay, so to kind of recap, you've got certainly the family influence that's supportive as a family unit and the example of both parents being communally involved, whether professionally or voluntarily, and a good foundation educationally with an interest in the international world.
Mm-hmm.
And agriculture as part of international, because the first thing you go on is agriculture plus international. So you don't think of it as something other than what you know either.
And even though my family, and particularly my mother, was extremely community oriented, going halfway around the world maybe was a little bit of a reach for her.
Oh yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
So sure that she was 100% enthusiastic about the approach I was taking, but on the other hand,
yeah.
You know, she didn't stand in my way.
I meant by the family support, I was thinking more of raising you and providing the kind of home environment.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
I marvel at what my folks did with some pretty meager resources.
Yeah, I think when we're honest, a lot of us do. But what was your family's religion?
My father's family were nominally Lutheran, but not really practicing a whole lot. My father's mother, I remember, did go to church in her later years, certainly.
Uh-huh.
And you know, some people talk about cramming for finals, but she did in her later years.
I'm sorry.
My father.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Was not active.
Uh-huh.
And my mother had been raised in the Lutheran Church, and was confirmed in the German language in the Lutheran Church, a language she probably had to learn to be confirmed in it by that time, being third generation.
Yeah.
And but anyway, when she went to high school, she lived in town. They lived about 6 miles out in the country in Door County, Sturgeon Bay area here in Wisconsin. And she moved into town to live with an older sister, so she'd be closer to high school. Fell in with some Methodists and started going to youth group with them and had a terrible crisis of conscience too.
Really?
Because when she was confirmed, the minister had apparently said, well, about the surest route to the hell would be to not adhere to the Lutheran Church. And so she was feeling kind of bad, wrote to an older sister in Milwaukee who was a nurse and told her about this. Older sister was a feminist before her time, before there was feminism. She was kind of a feisty person, and wrote back to my mother saying that she too was attending the Methodist Church in Milwaukee, and she would be personally responsible for my mother's spiritual well-being. So here's a person who has some confidence in her clout with God, I guess. And so I guess that eased my mother's conscience, and so when we were 6, 8 years old, hadn't really been going to church, but then my mother said, well, now we're going to start going to church, which we did, and you know, she was the Sunday school teacher, and
you mentioned
member of
that,
the official
yes.
board, and yeah. She was very, very active, and we were reasonably faithful attenders, I guess, so it was kind of a Methodist background.
Okay.
And one or more of our ministers was pretty much a pacifist.
Oh, okay.
Two of them I can think of. One during World War II, which was a tough position to be in during World War II. And another one who had been, I believe, a chaplain during World War I, possibly. And so we got a little bit of the non-belligerent point of view, and
Even though it's not as inherent in Methodism as it is in other religions.
It's not like the so-called peace groups, the Mennonites, Brethren, Quakers, etc. There is a little bit of it in the Methodist church, and I know this one minister, when my brother got to be a draftable age, he said, "Oh, you ought to consider, you know, being a conscientious objector." Well, I guess my brother and my family weren't quite ready to go that route. But I know there were those influences.
Do you think that that particular church factored into the IVS decision, or was that
a little bit? Yeah, a little bit.
Fairly peripheral. I don't know.
I think it was maybe more than peripheral.
Okay.
In that, you know, there were the overseas missionaries came around and told these kind of stories, and there was a little bit of the. There are more constructive things to do than fight a war and kind of philosophies, and so I think it played a role.
Yeah, you didn't mention it immediately, so I didn't think that it was the central thing.
Well, as I think back on it, when I wanted to leave to go overseas, I had to get permission from my draft board because I was a draftable age. The job I had worked in for General Motors was considered an essential job. So I had already gone through the physical for being drafted, etc., but General Motors had enough to say that they could keep me from being drafted.
GM has clout.
Yeah, and they had, I guess, what was a bona fide
case.
Essential
yeah.
job.
Yeah.
And so here I was kind of going to stride away from this naked into the world, and so I had to get some letters to my draft board. I wrote a letter to my draft board saying, hey, I wanted to leave General Motors, I wanted to work overseas, I thought I could serve my country better with what I was doing. And then I got some backup letters, I think from the local minister and maybe from somebody from the state 4-H club office who had been involved in the International Farm Youth Exchange. And to back this up, well, turned out that I was in an age group where they had something of a surplus of people relative to the draft quota. And so...
And it wasn't a problem.
It was not a... Yeah, they gave me permission. They may have thought that I was sort of evading in some way, but they didn't give any indication that they were opposed.
Yeah.
And there were local people on the draft board, and some of them probably knew my family, and probably knew we weren't malingerers or out and out evaders or
Not the deadbeats of the town
or something
like
that.
Okay.
So
let's get you fully integrated now into IBS. I think we've done pretty much the background and covered them very nice and thoroughly.
Then in May 1957, I found myself on the way to Vietnam. And
Washington first or straight over?
Straight over.
Okay.
And as I recall, it was a 36-hour flight from San Francisco to Tokyo in a propeller plane. It was not quick. There was a lot of vibrating between San Francisco and Tokyo.
And I think it's bad when it's 16 hours between Jacksonville and Osaka.
And Dr. Nofsinger, in his wisdom, had set things up so that we had the maximum length of time between plane connections in Tokyo and again in Hong Kong, so we could have a little time to look around at the airline's expense, and then on down to Vietnam. And like everybody, I suppose, I got out of the plane in Saigon, that air-conditioned plane, onto the broiling hot blacktop, and thought, oh my goodness, this is going to be my home for the next 2 years.
I'm going to be baked. Who was with you in the flight?
No one.
No, okay.
Except from San Francisco to Tokyo, about a 10-year-old boy who was going out to Japan to meet his uncle, and he got pretty squirmy after 36 hours.
Oh, I bet he did.
But the counter benefit was that they took him up to the cockpit to see all the pilots and the dials, and I said, hey, could I go along? So I got to walk up to the cockpit.
That's okay. Well, no, I was wondering if you had gone in a group of IBSers.
No, I was totally alone. Some of the others came over in pairs or threes.
Right,
but I was all alone.
Okay. Yeah, because I've been used to that.
And before I left, there was sort of a newsletter came out of the Bon Matuit group. It was maybe a report from Par Danforth and to IBS headquarters.
Well, that's the only place that IBS was, really,
correct,
at that time.
Correct. So I had a little idea of, you know, there were a number of people there, and here's what they were doing, and they had and Millie Scaff, one of the nurses, arrived maybe a week or two after myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was about our group in the Delta then.
That's a fairly big group.
Yeah. And we had about three Vietnamese living with us, later on four.
Uh-huh.
One was a driver.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two interpreters, young fellows, and later a third interpreter who married Orzella, the nurse, subsequently.
Was this, okay, this wasn't the brother of Mr. Chi, yeah, it was.
The brother, okay. Older brother of
older
Chi,
older brother Chi,
by the name Dooley, and the family name is Gui.
Yeah.
And so he was the first of the family to be employed by IBS later on. She was,
right.
And later on another...
Dom or something like that?
I'm not quite sure. But,
I can't.
Anyway, Dooley, as we call him, and Orzella did marry later on.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought about a comment in the letter from Dr. Nofsinger saying something to the effect, I can hardly refrain from thinking unkindly of Miss Bailey. It is true we want to establish good relations with the local population, but I hardly think this is the way to go about it.
Oh.
That you may want to censor out for the sake of the living.
Yeah, yeah.
But that,
yeah, that's,
that hit a nerve.
Yeah, I think some of the early folks who were married couples often had problems, mm-hmm. even if they were, you know.
I'm sure that Gordon and Shirley Brockmiller could tell you about mm-hmm. you know, difficulties they had, even though the Barwicks, I think, were very sympathetic to
mm-hmm.
their situation, but nonetheless.
No, Shirley told me about having to be in Saigon while she's pregnant, and you know, very little support, and Gordon away, and mm-hmm. and all of that. I mean, there just wasn't the thought that.
Well, IBS was not intended for married people.
No, not as originally conceived.
And so they were the first to be married and mm-hmm. be there as married people, and so I'm sure. I didn't appreciate it at the time, but I'm sure that it was not easy, especially for Shirley.
No, I don't think so. Well, she's a trooper, though.
Yeah.
She really is.
Yeah.
Sticks with things.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So, getting back to Kaesong.
Getting back to Kaesong. This is a nice group, and it represents the approach of a number of people with a number of different skills.
Exactly. We had a nurse. We had two nurses at,
two nurses,
at that time, because Orzella came down from Bon Matuit. Apparently, they weren't able to integrate her into a program there. So,
they mentioned
Parr
that.
Parr also took that upon himself to see if he couldn't integrate her there, along with Millie Scaff, the second nurse, and was successful, at least for the time being, in a provincial hospital. And then Bob Yates had sort of a poultry background, and that was really our first major project was helping to distribute poultry to these refugee families. And I don't know if you're aware, the Kaesong Project were refugees that had been settled on hastily dug canals on what had been very large French-owned and Vietnamese-owned rice plantations prior to the war. And so the poultry was really probably our biggest and only very visible project. And we were getting into integrated into a few other things, such as other types of livestock, water supply, gardening, etc., trying to feel our way as to what sorts of things we could do. We had taken some surveys and sort of senses of people that were there and what they had and what might enhance their lives, etc.
Oh, yeah. Sort of cadastral survey of land, and but also...
No, it was... The people were in place, they were on their canals in their sort of temporary huts, and they were just trying to reestablish themselves. And so it was a survey of human and human resources and property, I guess, and what they were trying to do, what they had, what they didn't have. And, you know, we were just sort of trying to get a footing when the word came that we were, you know, potentially to be assassinated. And so, as I said, arrived there in May, and I suspect around September is when we pulled out.
Yeah. Now, you told me before I started up here that how you got the word that...
The word was that the Viet Cong had sort of publicly announced that they were going to kill two Americans in the Mekong Delta. At least that's the way the story came to us. And
you seem to be the ones.
Well, we were there perhaps more on a more full-time basis than others, and it didn't necessarily mean us, but neither the American aid people or the IBS people felt it was wise that we should be there under those circumstances. And so we pulled out, joined the Ban Matuit group, consolidated the two groups. Millie Scaff went home at that point. Bill Shawley went home maybe slightly before that. And so several people left the group. Orzella married at about that time, and worked in Saigon at the Vietnamese American Association, and teaching English, and stayed there with her husband a couple of years, and eventually in about 1960 or 61 was able to get him out of the country, and they went back to the U.S.
A quick question about Millie or Mildred. I'll just pause this for a second. Okay, I'll turn it back on again. So you're up in
so early fall, September, thereabouts, we did leave the Delta.
I went up to
consolidate ourselves with the Ban Matuit group, part and fourth, left the country. And so John Barwick at that time was the sole chief of party. Paul Worthington was the assistant chief of party of the Ban Matuit group. I had been the assistant chief of party of the Kaisan group. That was something of, I don't know, an embarrassment that now we had two assistant chiefs of party and...
In the same place.
In the same place. And the question was whether one would no longer be chief of party, because there was a little salary stipend that went along with that. And so diplomatically, IBS said, well, we'll keep you both at that stipend, and I don't think either of us function in a very official way as assistant chief of party. I went about my project business, and I think Paul did, and if you know there was something that the chief of party wanted us to do, we did it, and but I don't think we were really often referred to as the assistant chiefs of party. Maybe Paul was more than myself, because that's what he had been.
And he had been there.
And he had been there, and yeah. I was a sort of a carpetbagger coming in there from the Delta. In the original survey that the Ban Matuit group had done, water supply was a big, very high on the list. These new villages of refugees were carrying water from a kilometer or more away, so that looked to me like my cup of tea. And so in the next weeks and months, with the help of people like Tom Lucian, made contact out in the villages and said, hey, we'd like to try drilling some wells out here, and I set about building a set of equipment, and again, Tom helped me with a lot of decontacts and helped me with the work and in many ways, and so we successfully drilled a well and successfully hit water in one village, and then we moved to another village where we did four wells and got either pumps or buckets on the wells, etc. So that carried us up to about the end of 57, and that, you know, that to me was a very satisfying, rewarding type of project.
Yeah, how would you, and maybe this was Tom doing it, but how would you folks approach people and say, hey, we'd like to do this? Would it, how much was, were they with you in terms of figuring out where to do things, involved in the discussion of whether you should do it, etc.?
The
I'm looking at the self-help approach.
The Catholic priests were the secular as well as the religious leaders in the villages. There was nominally a village chief, but as far as I could ascertain, it was the, you know, the Catholic priest who had the real clout and leadership. Yeah. He was the one who had led his people out of the north. And so most of my experience was in one particular village, and went in, talked to the priest, and said, we'd like to try, you know, drilling some wells. We have some equipment we've made here to do this, and you can choose the locations within the village where you want them, want the well. What I will be here every day. What we would like is three villagers to do the physical work here with us. And so as it turned out, every morning, three people would show up. I'm not sure they always were happy to be there, but
the priest calls the shots.
Such was the power of the village priest that if he wanted them there, they were there.
Yeah.
And so we learned how to do this as the people in the village did it. We sort of evolved the technology, I guess. And after we had done four wells, I remember saying to the priest, well, we've done four wells in your village, I think that's enough now, you know, we ought to move along to someplace else. And he said, oh, you wanted more wells, and I said, well, that was all right, that, you know, his people had really done these wells, and they could continue to do more wells, and he said, oh, well, but, you know, you've got to have your know-how, and I said, well, look, you know, I didn't know anything about this when I started, and I learned this on the job, and he was quite a jolly guy, and he laughed, and he said, oh, I see now that you come over here and learn things in Vietnam, and then you go home and make big money. And that was his way of needling us. He was, you know, a very, very jolly guy, and we actually lived at his house. We'd come out there on a Monday morning, and he had kind of a spare lean-to on his straw house there, and
little bed platform.
There was a bed in there, and then I brought an army cot along, and this was one of the times that I said to the Vietnamese interpreter, a fellow by the name of Quy,
I said, I've heard of him,
that he could have the bed and I would sleep in the army cot, which he did, and or most of the time. And it turned out that the bed apparently was infested. And so during the day,
he's scratching.
He was beside himself, and I was okay. And we ate our meal, took our meals at Father's house. And Tom Lucci had described the situation. He said the father has a really filthy kitchen, but the cook makes great food. And I do remember after my several months tenure there that went down to Saigon and I was having some intestinal problems, and they checked out my specimen, and the technician said, "Man, you're loaded." So I guess I had a number of different species there.
Well, that's part of the volunteer experience.
I guess it is, yeah.
Yeah. Everyone has to have at least one worm in there.
You know, I guess there's the external experience and the internal experience.
Yeah, I had my own internal experiences.
So
let me tell you a kind of funny story of my own. I'll pause this for a moment because Arctic is
that's not
on.
Totally germane. But
yeah,
our first Thanksgiving in Vietnam, as I recall, we were had a nice Thanksgiving dinner. Mrs. Mm-hmm. Barwick had arranged and mm-hmm. so forth. But Tom Lucci was not eating as heartily as the rest of us because he was in the middle of a purge for a tapeworm.
Mm-hmm.
And so after dinner in the afternoon, he passed this worm, and so he had this monster here, and we were all helping him get the snarls out of it so we could lay it out straight
and to measure it.
And it turned out to be 32 feet, as I recall. And
that's a good one.
We mentioned this sometime later to the Mennonite doctor, and he said, "Oh, I've seen him much bigger." So he wasn't at all impressed. Whether he had or not.
Yeah.
No,
kind of deflating.
You know, he wasn't going to give us.
He's like, "Oh, I got 32 feet.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. That's quite an experience. So we're going from May and your arrival.
Okay,
and then
I'm through the end of the year.
And through the end of the year.
Uh-huh. And somewhere along.
Because you said that 18 months for Ban Mie Thuy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm kind of counting sort of a total of 6 months for Kaesong, and then the remainder of the two-year period.
For the Ban Mie Thuy area, et cetera. Yeah.
And somewhere into 1958, then a couple of things happened. Number one, the president of Vietnam announced that the refugees were fully reoriented fully integrated into society and economy and so forth. So this put the American aid group that was known as refugee resettlement in a rather odd position, since there were no refugees anymore officially.
Official refugees anyway, yeah.
And so they, as I recall, renamed themselves Field Services. And so we were then under the Field Services group rather than refugee resettlement group. But their existence then was a little shaky and tenuous. And I think within the American Aid Group there was a little bit of pushing and shoving as to who might get control of these IBS people, some of whom, you know, looked like they would be useful.
Oh, uh-huh, yeah.
And so that was one aspect. And eventually then, you've heard the name Howard Harper was...
Not too frequently.
Okay. Howard Harper was an arrival with the American Aid people, was an agriculturist, an agronomist. And I think in the pushing and shoving and muscling, he kind of finessed it. And he became the guy who was going to oversee IBS.
Uh-huh. At least from the AID standpoint.
From the AID standpoint.
Yeah.
And from the IBS standpoint, let me put a little preamble in here. I'm gonna say some things that may sound negative or critical, but I would hasten to make the statement I had a very good experience with IBS. I think of it as a good time and led to a lot of other good things. So
yes.
If I say something negative, or it may be strictly a minority viewpoint, it should be taken in the context of what I consider a positive experience. Anyway, IBS then, I would say, did not have strong leadership and did not have a strong position. IBS, you know, had sort of come in with the self-help community development approach, sort of a holistic approach, and this was really not the USAID approach. USAID approach was to infuse money and equipment and to try to make a fairly good showing in a quick short period of time, etc.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the IVS philosophy and the AID philosophy perhaps did not totally mesh. And probably if IVS had stayed doing what it was doing, its contract very likely would not have been renewed after the first 2 years. I think there would have been, it would have been in jeopardy. But what happened is that Howard Harper kind of gained control, IVS acquiesced to it, and then he became kind of a cheerleader for IVS and saying, hey, these young people, they're enthusiastic, they're doing this, and we ought to renew their contract. And they were a big asset to Howard Harper and others who wanted to carry out certain projects. At the same time, I guess I would say that IVS probably lost any pretense of autonomy vis-a-vis AID at this juncture. And some people like myself considered it kind of a sellout. But what I just said, I think probably the contract may not have been renewed had there not been a change in the relationship and a change in who ran IVS and its volunteers.
In a practical sense.
In a practical sense.
Yeah. So this was pretty much Barwick going along with this?
Yeah, he was in his latter part of his 2 years by then. And
He was only a 2 year kind of volunteer level person?
Well, he was more than a volunteer. He was hired there as chief of party. He was, I suppose, well up in his 60s by then. He was not tremendously interested in the technical or project aspects so much as providing a house and a place for the IVS volunteers. And he was concerned about our health, which was important in view of the fact of how many of us had had hepatitis, and I think, you know, in all fairness,
32-foot worms. And
I think the health, definitely with his wife intervening in the kitchen, and probably driving a few Vietnamese cooks to distraction with cleanliness and so forth, I think it paid off, probably. But I think he saw AID sort of taking over the day-to-day operations of what people did as a kind of an altar for him.
And he certainly wasn't opposed to it, because then he would have tried to stop it. So he was going along saying, well, maybe this is the best.
He acquiesced, and Howard Harper was fairly smooth. You know, he could finesse John a little bit, I think, and people in general. The second thing I would say in defense of this change is that in later years, when I had more contact with the Peace Corps in the Niger Republic, their way of operating was pretty much to plunk down volunteers in different locations, maybe give them a job that lasted for 2 months as peanut buyer in the market or something for the government cooperative agency. And after that time, it was sort of up to them to find their own niche and their own project and what they could do. And I guess by observation, I would say that, you know, maybe the best 10 to 20% found a meaningful project that they could start, carry out, and do something really good. The large majority probably were underemployed, I would say, personal opinion. Underemployed, and probably went home after 2 years saying, well, gosh, I didn't accomplish much. It was a good experience. I know these people, but I really didn't accomplish a lot. So if I transfer the fact that young people, maybe directly out of college, many of them find it pretty hard to plunk down in a certain area and size up the resources and lack thereof and come up with a meaningful short-term project that can leave the place and better than they found it.
You're right. I think I agree with that completely.
So, in that sense, perhaps AID's more direct control over IVS gave a number of people more meaningful work than they might have had otherwise. That's only something we can speculate on. For me, who had had the well project, etc., that I thought was very meaningful, it was a bit of a sellout.
Mm-hmm. And it would also give you some possible constrictions that you didn't need.
Exactly.
And, at least on a personal basis.
And what happened is that then Howard Harper came up with the idea of some plant and seed multiplication centers.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Were those the sites developed when Rockmuller was in charge of Chief Party? Okay.
Yeah. And this his leadership, Brock's leadership is kind of evolving here because I and the others started clearing land for some of these at Harper's behest. And in typical style, he said, hey, you got to start clearing this land. I told him in Saigon it was already cleared and so forth. You know, you're putting me in a bad situation here.
He's worried about his reports.
The big man is coming up in another few weeks to look this thing over. So. I learned he was able to get a bulldozer from another aid project, and so I learned, along with a few others, to drive this, and we cleared land and so forth, and put some of this land into production. As these first weeks and months went by, I think he could probably detect that I and Paul Worthington, who were sort of the likely leaders here, were more questioning and less enthusiastic than somebody like Brock, who came off a farm, and this looked a lot like farming, and he felt very good about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so he sort of developed into the leadership role. I, in a sense, was traded off to another aid man who was in charge of heavy machinery for land clearing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell a little bit about this project, but I always felt I had been traded off to this other aid man for some tractors and machinery that Howard Harper needed at the plant multiplication center. That was very clear in my mind whether it was the truth or not. I think it's reasonably true. And so I went to work for an agency in Vietnam that was known as Land Development. In a sense, it was the successor to the Refugee Resettlement Project, because it was a Vietnamese agency that was recruiting people in overcrowded coastal areas to move up to unpopulated or thinly populated highland areas to reestablish themselves and farm. And this land needed to be cleared, therefore they had heavy machinery to do the clearing, etc.
This would be like the Ban Mae Thuot thing, but only internal rather than bringing them from the north.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. It was. And the government information was that these people were volunteers. It was sort of felt that they weren't really volunteers, that they were conscripts, that they had been rounded up in some of these crowded areas, put up into areas, and not necessarily at their own maybe against their will to some degree. There was another rift developed between USAID and the Vietnamese government on this program, and that was the viability of locations that the Vietnamese government was choosing. The Vietnamese government had political ends in mind. They wanted these thinly populated areas peopled by Vietnamese, by South Vietnamese, because they were along the border with Cambodia and Laos. Very leaky.
Mm-hmm.
The more Vietnamese they could have there, etc., the better it was politically.
And perhaps militarily.
Exactly. And the American aid program had a concern that a lot of these areas were not sustainable, they were not agriculturally viable, etc. So American aid program foot dragged, but they did supply the heavy equipment through this aid person, Gene Garner, under whom I then worked. And
Gene Garner, would I have heard his name?
Probably not.
That I might, in my own experience, just be dredging somebody up.
He was an American aid technician. Mm-hmm. He was an agricultural engineer, if not by formal training, certainly by experience and by skills. And He was in charge of bringing in the heavy equipment, the bulldozers, etc., for land clearing, for setting up repair shops in Saigon. Mm-hmm. And he wanted me out in the field, sort of as his eyes in the field. And I, you know, went through the maintenance manuals and made sheets as to what the maintenance should have been. I went out, mm-hmm. and he wanted me there sort of as inspector general to see if maintenance was being carried out, which frequently it wasn't. And
preventive maintenance,
you know,
sort of thing.
You know, the developing country syndrome starts